on the failed leadership in Washington. When civil society is healthy, most people do not look to Washington for the answers to their problems. We look closer to home. It is only when the forests have been cleared that we can see distant peaks. But when the family and civil society are depleted or dysfunctional, we do not lose our desire to belong to something, nor do we lose our need for help when misfortune befalls us. And there is the state, offering to fill in where other institutions have failed or fled. Statists have argued since the founding that the government in Washington is the answer to our problems. That argument is more persuasive when the forests have been cleared away and all eyes look naturally to Washington. This trend benefited Barack Obama because his political philosophy is consistent with it, and his campaign always encouraged the idea that he was the representation of a national awakening of some kind. His slogan, "We are the ones we've been waiting for," was a brilliant, if creepy, New Age form of populism. But the erosion of civil society and the traditional economy also helped Donald Trump. Where Obama pressed a technocratic progressive vision of the government as every citizen's partner and helpmate, Donald Trump offered nostalgia and nationalism. I'll get to the specifics of Donald Trump's message in a moment, but I need to take a moment to deal with nationalism as an ideology generally. There is a raging debate in conservative circles about nationalism that divides many traditional allies and friends. At National Review, where I am a senior editor, some of my colleagues have led the charge for conservatism to embrace what my friends Richard Lowry and Ramesh Panuru call benign nationalism. They write, "It includes loyalty to one's country, a sense of belonging, allegiance, and gratitude to it. And this sense attaches to the country's people and culture, not just its political institutions and laws. Such nationalism includes solidarity with one's countrymen, whose welfare comes first, albeit not to the complete exclusion of that of foreigners. When this nationalism finds political expression, it supports a federal government that is jealous of its sovereignty, forthright and unapologetic about advancing its people's interests, and mindful of the need for national cohesion." On the surface, my only objections to this are terminological. But terminology matters, given that rhetoric shapes how we think about the world we live in. What Lowry and Panuru are referring to here, by my lights, is not really nationalism, but patriotism. Nationalism is a universal phenomenon. Generically, it has no ideological content save glorification of whatever nation it manifests itself in. In this, it is somewhat similar to generic conservatism and radicalism. A conservative in Russia wants to conserve very different things from a conservative in the United Kingdom. A radical in Spain wants to tear down very different things from what a radical wants to tear down in Saudi Arabia. Likewise, a nationalist celebrates different things in every nation. One could make the same argument about patriotism, of course. A patriot here is different from a patriot over there. But in the American context, patriotism is defined by adherence to a set of principles and ideals that is higher than mere nationalism. It is also a cultural orientation that is inherent to the idea of American exceptionalism. Despite a common misunderstanding on both the right and the left, American exceptionalism never meant we're better than everyone else. It wasn't jingoism. It was an observation. Until the last decade or so, the long-running argument over American exceptionalism wasn't whether we are or are not exceptional, but whether our obvious exceptionalism was a good thing. For the left, which wanted America to be more like Europe, it was bad. For the right, both the isolationist and internationalist factions, American exceptionalism was something to be proud of. But it never meant nationalism. Nationalism, by definition, is concerned with the collective will or spirit. Like arguments about the moral equivalent of war, the fundamental assumptions and emotional heart of nationalism are the cult of unity. We're all in it together. Let's unite around a cause larger than ourselves. The word fascism is based on fasces, a bundle of sticks around an axe, which was the symbol of Roman authority and meant strength in numbers. In America, patriotism can include these things in moments of crisis, but it never loses sight of the fact that the fundamental unit of our constitutional order is not the group, but the individual. To the nationalist, the heroic entity is the righteous crowd. To the patriot, the hero is the man who, with the law on his side, stands up to the crowd. G.K. Chesterton captured the difference well. "My country, right or wrong," is a thing that no patriot would think of saying. It is like saying, "My mother, drunk or sober." I have always argued that a little nationalism is essential to the American project. Nationalism is a pre-rational, emotional, ultimately tribal commitment to one's home country. This place is mine and I love it, not least because it is mine. We are products of the nations we hail from, and a minimal amount of gratitude and appreciation for where we come from is good and healthy. But if a little nationalism is healthy, too much of it is poisonous. Indeed, all poisons are determined by the dose. In other words, nationalism is not, properly speaking, an ideology at all. It is a passion, like lust. Sexual attraction is important for every marriage, but no healthy marriage is based on lust. Strong unions depend on shared values, commitment to certain principles and projects that are more important than the self. So it is with nations. The founders recognized that political passion is dangerous, which is why they set up a system designed to keep it in check. Historically, nationalism has always been at war with such artificial restraints on the will of the people, which is why historians usually use the term romantic nationalism. Romantic nationalism emerges in the waning days of the French Revolution, when French and German intellectuals and the masses rebelled against the cold rationality and legalisms of the Enlightenment. The Jacobins of the Great Terror were committed nationalists, convinced that the French were God's chosen people. They inscribed the words, "The citizen is born, lives, and dies for the fatherland," above every altar and plastered it on every thoroughfare. Robespierre did not shrink from embracing nationalism. "I am French. I am one of thy representatives, O sublime people. Accept the sacrifices of my whole being. Happy is the man who is born in your midst. Happier is he who can die for your happiness." In Germany, intellectuals like Johann Gottfried Herder and Johann Fichte rose up against, first, the Enlightenment-based autocracy of Frederick the Great, and then the cold militaristic pragmatism of Napoleon's empire. Reason and science served to disenchant the world, to borrow Max Weber's phrase, and nationalism was a re-enchantment creed, to borrow Ernest Gellner's words. Nationalism, with its myths and fables, would restore some of the meaning lost to the age of reason. Marxism would soon provide another such creed. Herder and Fichte borrowed heavily from Rousseau and his idea of creating a society based upon the general will, which Herder redefined as the Volksgeist, or spirit of the people. He and Fichte used the German language as the defining feature of the mythical German nation. French was the language of Enlightenment thinking, which suppressed the German soul. "Spew out that ugly slime of the Seine," Herder exhorted. "Speak German, O you German." Men are formed by language far more than language is by men, Fick believed. The German tongue was pure, he insisted, because it had defied the corruption of not just the slime of the Seine, but the foreign ideas of the Roman Empire and its alien Latin tongue. The Germans still speak a living language, and have done so ever since it first streamed forth from nature, whereas the other Teutonic tribes speak a language that stirs only on the surface, yet is dead at the root. Fichte was no biological racist, though he was no fan of the Jews. But his ideas about language would later lend themselves to the more virulent ethnic nationalism of the Nazis. Fichte wrote of the Germans, "Of all modern peoples, it is you in whom the seed of human perfection most decidedly lies, and to whom the lead in its development is assigned. If you perish in your essentiality, then all the hopes of the entire human race for salvation from the depths of its misery perish with you." Racial essentialism, tribal superiority, the elevation of passion and myth. Nationalism is not only powerless against these things, it is the medium by which these passions grow like bacteria in a petri dish. Nationalism works on the assumption that the search for meaning and spiritual redemption is a collective enterprise. Lowry and Panuru's benign nationalism is certainly at odds with such things, because the best part of American culture stands athwart mindless passions. But all the valuable work in the concept of benign nationalism is done by the word benign, not nationalism. That's because nationalism, shorn of negating qualifiers, has no internal checks, no limiting principles that mitigate against giving in to collective passion. And that is why nationalism, taken to its logical extreme, must become statism or some form of socialism. It is a vestigial nostrum of Marxism and Leninism that nationalism and socialism are opposites. But everywhere nationalism has free rein, it becomes some kind of socialism. And every time socialism is set loose in an actual nation, it becomes nationalism. Take a speech by Hugo Chavez or Fidel Castro and replace words like nationalist and nationalize with socialist and socialize. The meaning of the sentence will not change. When you nationalize an industry, you socialize it, and vice versa. When you leave the page and leap into the real world, the terms are not opposites. They are synonyms. Nationalism uncaged has to become statism, because the state is the only institution that is supposed to represent all of us. Which brings us back to Donald Trump. In his inaugural address, President Trump laid out his vision of the new order. At the bedrock of our politics will be a total allegiance to the United States of America, and through our loyalty to our country, we will rediscover our loyalty to each other. This is the same song sung by Barack Obama, just set to a different tune, aimed at different ears. Both men bought into the idea that all of America's problems could be fixed from Washington. Their programs and rhetoric were different in all sorts of important ways, but the underlying assumption of both men was that if we have the right person in the Oval Office, we can transform the country, or make America great again. In this, Trump differed from traditional conservatives who argue that Washington is too powerful and too involved in our lives and the economy. Trump argued, or shouted, that Washington elites were too weak, too stupid, to fix our problems. He insisted it would be easy to provide better health care to everyone while spending less money at the same time. He could single-handedly counter the tide of globalization through his superior deal-making. There would be so much winning, he warned his followers, that they would one day suffer from chronic winning fatigue. Just as the decay of civil society made the hearts of liberals, but not just liberals, receptive to Barack Obama's re-enchantment creed of fundamentally transforming America, it made many conservatives, but not just conservatives, as Trump won millions of votes from Obama voters, receptive to Trump's America First nationalism. Ultimately, the question of whether polarization in American politics breeds tribal thinking or tribal thinking breeds polarization can only be answered with both. But what is clear is that a large amount of Trump's support in the election, and to this day, stems from a desire to fight fire with fire. In hundreds of arguments, conversations, and debates with Trump's most enthusiastic supporters, and many of his reluctant ones, the loudest refrain was that we live with Trump or we die with Hillary. For the true believers, this was an exciting choice. For the more skeptical ones, it was a lamentable but necessary one. The traditional American conservative vision of limited government and free markets had passed its sell-by date. The choice now is progressivism or nationalism. Progressivism, in other words, conjured a nationalist backlash that is less an alternative to the statism of the left and more a right-wing version of it. We should take a moment to look at how it happened. There's a deep confusion within progressivism. On the one hand, progressives take deep pride in their role as agents of social change. Often they have every reason to be proud. If you believe in the causes of, say, civil rights and feminism, why wouldn't you celebrate your accomplishments? But at the same time, progressives want to claim that any effort to resist the forces of progress is an act of aggression in the culture war. From abortion and gay marriage to the hot fad for transgender rights, progressives want every institution and community to bend the knee to their movement. And when anyone refuses, the resistors are cast as the aggressors. The slogan, "Make America Great Again," worked on many levels because it is so diversely interpretable. But a key part of Trump's MAGA appeal was the notion that we could return to a simpler, often mythological time where middle-class jobs dangled from trees like ripe fruit, the police had a free hand to deal with troublemakers, and political correctness didn't ruin everyone's fun. MAGA, particularly when adorned with all of the other nationalist and populist rhetoric, fell in the great Herdian tradition of conjuring myths of an imagined past where we, the right people, weren't humiliated by foreigners at home or abroad. Even among the ranks of Trump-supporting conservatives who understood he was in all likelihood selling snake oil, this mindset won the argument. Michael Anton, a multimillionaire hedge fund partner and part-time intellectual who now works for the Trump administration, wrote a famous pseudonymous essay for the Claremont Review of Books titled "The Flight 93 Election." In it, he argued that America was essentially doomed if Hillary Clinton was elected. So, like the passengers who overpowered the terrorists on 9/11, there was no choice but to back Trump. Selfless courage was required, according to Anton, but not so much courage as to risk losing his job by publishing under his own name. This argument was widely subscribed to by many leading conservatives, even many who had once been passionate opponents of Trump. The imperial arrogance of progressive social engineers and social justice warriors had earned an apocalyptic backlash so powerful that even clear-eyed conservatives who recognized Trump's dishonesty and demagoguery couldn't resist it. Indeed, as much as I hold Trump in contempt, I am still compelled to admit that if my vote would have decided the election, I probably would have voted for him. Make America Great Again captured the spirit of the backlash. It invoked nostalgic claims about trade, foreign policy, crime, culture, and economics. but the most salient and illustrative platform for the Trump agenda was immigration. The Swiss writer Max Frisch famously said of the guest workers his country imported that, "We wanted workers, but we got people instead." That insight applies most poignantly to Europe. The massive influx of immigrants from the Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia had the predictable consequence, testing national and local institutions and giving rise to huge spikes in populism and calls for more authoritarianism. Many on the left concede that immigration is fueling a populist backlash, but they then take the position that the backlash is racist and bigoted and therefore politically illegitimate. No doubt mass immigration elicits racist and other bigoted attitudes in some segments of the population. But relying on these sorts of explanations encourages a kind of smug virtue signaling. People who don't like immigration are backward bigots, unlike me. Such responses not only miss the complexity of the issue, but also encourage further resentment among the segments of society being demonized. In a sense, it is a kind of victim blaming. For instance, at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, work is far more often a matter of physical labor. If you have little or no education, working with your hands is usually your only option. Importing large numbers of competitors who keep wages down, or are perceived to be doing so, is not going to be celebrated by the day laborers with nearly the gusto that one hears from journalists and the well-heeled. If we started importing very large numbers of pundits who could do the same job as the editors of the New York Times for half the price, one might find a bit more nuance in their pages. I tend to believe that high levels of immigration, particularly skills-based immigration, are economically desirable policies. Also, the evidence that low-skilled immigration is a net detriment to the country is not as cut and dried as some claim. The field of economics that studies immigration is shot through with methodological and ideological problems. But the simple fact is that, as with trade and automation, all economic policies create winners and losers. Proponents of very large levels of immigration almost invariably tend to be in the winners column, and a dismayingly high proportion of them also tend to be condescendingly dismissive of the complaints of the losers. When I talk to wealthy audiences, I will often point out that the people in the room only know two kinds of immigrants, either extremely hard-working manual laborers who tend to do their landscaping or clean their homes and offices, and extremely hard-working and highly educated, wealthy citizens of the world like themselves. In neither instance do the members of the audience have any reason to feel threatened by immigrants, economically or culturally. Their children will not be going to the overwhelmed public schools of the day laborers, and if the children of affluent immigrants attend their children's private schools, all the better. Diversity is a wonderful thing. Being rich can mean being able to afford generosity at someone else's expense. Regardless, it's a mistake to put all of the emphasis on economic arguments about immigration. Economists are very good at describing the world through models, but they tend to downgrade, dismiss, or demonize the cultural and psychological costs of immigration. So when it comes to immigration, economists talk about workers, labor costs, productivity, and all manner of costs and benefits. But those models are silent on all the other costs and benefits: social cohesion, civic and institutional health, community trust, that are difficult to quantify. But it's not impossible. A recent paper by Ronald Engelhardt of the University of Michigan and Pippa Norris of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government found that the bulk of the evidence points to the rise of populism in America and Europe having more to do with cultural backlash than economic dislocation. Their cultural backlash theory includes issues other than immigration. Feminism, gay rights, and other forms of progressive change are part of the psychological mix. But there's reason to believe that immigration is probably the biggest driver of cultural backlash in populist strongholds. A recent study by researchers at the London School of Economics found that while levels of unemployment didn't correlate very tightly with populist support for Brexit, levels of immigration did. An earlier 2012 study found that opposition to immigration had less to do with economic concerns than worries about what newcomers would do to the composition of the local population and how it would affect their neighborhoods, schools, and workplaces. A lot of the political science literature on this topic is replete with ad hominem labels, or technically neutral labels used in ad hominem ways. Racism, xenophobia, nativism, bigotry, isolationism, etc. And while it is tragically true that it is easy to find examples to back up such descriptors, the tragedy is compounded when we use these terms as a blanket condemnation of anyone who has objections to mass-scale immigration. In other words, all racist xenophobes and white supremacists are opposed to immigration. But not all immigration opponents are racists and xenophobes. National Review magazine has been at the forefront of those arguing that if responsible politicians don't deal with the legitimate concerns of voters with regard to immigration, the issue will be taken up by irresponsible politicians, because in the minds of voters, they are the only ones talking about the problem. The 2016 election proved us right. Donald Trump's rhetoric on immigration during the campaign was like a mirror of the most cartoonish platitudes of the left. While pro-immigration absolutists scoff at any suggestion that immigrants are anything other than the noblest of Americans, Trump often painted immigrants, particularly illegal immigrants, as the dregs of humanity. For instance, Hillary Clinton said that Islam has nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism. And Donald Trump, by vowing to ban all Muslims, at least initially, made it clear that he thinks Islam has everything to do with terrorism. The same dynamic played itself out with his constant invocation of the statistically unrepresentative number of crimes committed by illegal immigrants. This rhetorical tactic helped Trump in two ways. First, he demagogically played on the natural tribal instinct of fear of others. But second, he signaled that he was willing to defy the politically correct rules of the weak and stupid establishment. In other words, the left painted with a broad brush in a single color, and so did Trump. And when that happens, there is no room for the shading and contrast necessary to describe the world as it actually is. One scholar who has tried is Harvard sociologist Robert D. Putnam, a decent left-wing liberal who is arguably America's leading social scientist on civil society and community. In a massive survey of over 30,000 Americans, he found that there was an undeniable correlation between increased diversity and breakdowns in community. He is adamant that racism isn't the primary explanation. In fact, supporters of the idea that racism is the primary driver of anti-immigrant sentiment have never paid much attention to the immigration controversies of the 19th and early 20th centuries, or the anti-immigrant sentiment in Africa and the Middle East in which race plays no role. According to Putnam, people who live in more diverse communities tend to distrust their neighbors regardless of the color of their skin, to withdraw even from close friends, to expect the worst from their community and its leaders, to volunteer less, give less to charity and work on community projects less often, to register to vote less, to agitate for social reform more but have less faith that they can actually make a difference, and to huddle unhappily in front of the television. In short, he writes, people living in ethnically diverse settings appear to hunker down, that is, to pull in like a turtle. Putnam hated his findings and recognized that they would not be well received by his peers. So he spent a year retesting the numbers for some other explanations. he couldn't find any. In ethnically or culturally homogeneous communities, there is more social trust and more social capital. People who share languages, customs, faiths, institutions, and plain old history are simply more likely to work out their differences and problems without looking to the government to do it for them. In short, a shared culture builds trust, which is essential to democracy and economic growth. Trust, writes Francis Fukuyama, is the expectation that arises within a community of regular, honest, and cooperative behavior based on commonly shared norms on the part of members of that community. Think of a typical postcard hamlet in Europe where kids dress in communal garb, parents organize festivals, and everyone goes to the same church. Is it any wonder that there would be a larger reservoir of social trust and cooperativeness in such a community than in a diverse city full of strangers and newcomers? Sweden and other Scandinavian countries have been the beau ideal of American progressives for generations. What has been hard for those same progressives to grapple with is that ethnic homogeneity and a strong cultural consensus make social democracy much easier to pull off. One can say without fear of contradiction that the influx of immigrants and refugees into these countries, and others like Germany, the UK, the Netherlands, France, etc., has not contributed to greater social peace. There is no value judgment here. Traditional small-town life can be wonderful. It can also be stultifying for those who want something more, or merely something else. The medieval German expression, Stadt Luft macht frei, city air makes you free, captured this distinction. Moving to the city has always meant escaping from the more ordered and tradition-bound ways of rural life. The customs, festivals, May Day dances, whatever, of traditional communities aren't merely quaint cultural activities. They are circuits of social trust, solidarity, and cooperation. It is right and good to value inclusiveness, but inclusiveness can only go so far and do so much. Christians can visit a mosque, but they probably can't pray there regularly. People who speak Korean are simply going to have a hard time forging relationships with people who don't. The share of the foreign-born U.S. population is at an all-time high. In 1960, the foreign-born population was obviously smaller in absolute terms and as a share of the country, but it also overwhelmingly consisted of immigrants from Europe and Canada, 84%, people who have an easier time assimilating into the majority culture. Mexicans made up 6% of the foreign-born population, and other Latin Americans, another 3.5%, for a total of 9.5% of the foreign-born population. In 2014, 27.7% came from Mexico and another 23.9% from other Latin American countries. Of the 48 million students enrolled in K-12 public schools in 2012, nearly 1 in 4 spoke a language other than English at home. People often note that we've had similar proportions of foreign-born students in public schools before, though we are in uncharted territory when it comes to the absolute numbers. They cite the success immigrants who came through Ellis Island had at finding and achieving the American dream. That is a great story and one that I love. What they leave out is that in those days, America at the state, local, and federal levels was absolutely determined to turn immigrants into Americans. Sometimes that effort was too draconian, as in World War I, when German speakers were essentially persecuted for even speaking their native language in public. They also leave out the fact that the U.S. economy was geared in such a way that it could absorb waves of immigrants. George Borjas notes that in 1914, 75% of the workforce at the Ford Motor Company were immigrants. Industrial America is not doing nearly as poorly as some claim, thanks largely to huge advances in automation and innovation. But does anyone believe it can absorb waves of unskilled foreign workers the way it once did? But the schools, churches, and popular culture had both the tools and the will to encourage assimilation. Today, all of the will is on the other side of the equation. There is a large and aggressive educational and political lobby that works against assimilation and strives to create ever more incentives for immigrants as well as native-born ethnic groups to maintain their minority identity at all costs. Assimilation is still popular among many immigrants and many native-born Americans, but it is on the outs precisely where it is most needed. In the University of California system, an administration memo cautions faculty and staff not to use certain language that can lead to microaggressions, which the UC system defines as the everyday verbal, nonverbal, and environmental slights, snubs, or insults, whether intentional or unintentional, that communicate hostile, derogatory, or negative messages to target persons based solely upon their marginalized group membership. One example of an offensive, hostile, or derogatory statement? Saying, America is a melting pot. This sends the signal that the speaker expects minorities to assimilate to the dominant culture. Well, yeah. Whatever your preferred policy on immigration might be, my own is simply to have one and enforce it. It should be remembered that fear and distrust of strangers is entirely natural. I do not like the demagoguery and demonization of immigrants that is thriving on the right these days. But the fact is that such responses are a feature of human nature. That doesn't excuse overt acts of bigotry or cruelty, but it should at least instill a little humility and empathy in people who think nativism is nothing more than know-nothingism. Many of the people concerned with immigration know something far better than their critics do. Their communities are changing in ways they do not like. Donald Trump tapped into the frustrations of millions of people fed up with the failed promises of politicians who said they would do something about the problem. I don't like how he did it, and I think he will ultimately fail in fulfilling most of his promises, probably resulting in even more populist anger. But that doesn't mean the concerns he tapped into were wholly illegitimate. Again, polarization fuels these trends, and these trends fuel polarization. To understand how, it is important to understand the degree to which the erosion of civil society has caused millions of Americans to flock to partisan politics as a source of tribal meaning. Political parties in America were not always particularly ideological. If someone told you that she was a Republican or a Democrat in, say, 1950, you would need more information before you could guess whether she was a conservative or a liberal. There were very progressive Republicans, and there were very conservative Democrats. But in the last few decades, starting in the 1960s and intensifying with almost every passing year, the parties have become not only more ideological, but tribal. Today, political parties are no longer just the people who are supposed to govern the way you want. They are a team to support and a tribe to feel a part of. And the public's view of politics is becoming more and more zero-sum. It's about helping their team win and making sure the other team loses, writes Amanda Taub, who covers social science for the New York Times. Partisanship, for a long period of time, wasn't viewed as part of who we are, explained political scientists Shanto Iyengar and Sean J. Westwood. It wasn't core to our identity. It was an ancillary trait. But in the modern era, we view party identity as something akin to gender, ethnicity, or race, the core traits that we use to describe ourselves to others. But now partisanship is becoming a bigger predictor of behavior and attitudes than race. As other sources of meaning wither, and as we think of ourselves as residents of the national community rather than local ones, the stakes of politics inevitably increase, not just in terms of policy, but psychologically. The logic of sports and war takes over. If they win, we lose, and vice versa. Citizens in California and New York become invested in partisan fights in North Carolina or Indiana as if they were skirmishes in a larger war. The tribal us-versus-them worldview is intensified on social media, where it is easier to find like-minded but virtual friends 1,000 miles away than it is to have a conversation with your actual neighbor. On both sides of the political aisle, the point of politics ceases to be persuasion and becomes instead victory, humiliation, and rubbing it in. Studies have shown that when people see someone being shocked with electrodes, the parts of the observer's brain that feel pain light up as well. In one study, this empathetic response was more likely when the observer was told the victim was a fan of their favorite soccer team. But when the observer was told the subject was a fan of a rival team, the pleasure centers of the observer's brain lit up instead. This is pure tribalism, and it is wired into us. When one of my people suffers, I feel pain. When the other suffers, I take delight. I am unaware of whether similar experiments were conducted using ideological or political tribes, but I have no doubt that the same thing would happen. The suffering of liberal avatars is something for conservatives to revel in, and vice versa. In the aftermath of terror attacks and mass shootings, the left openly hopes that the perpetrator was an angry white male belonging to some right-wing hate group. When the murderer is confirmed as a radical Muslim, many right-wingers struggle to contain their glee that their worldview has been confirmed. Facebook and Twitter have become platforms where you boast of your purity and commitment to the good things and how your ideological opposites are not only corrupt, but metaphysically committed to the bad things. There is a curious paradox of tribal polarization on the left and the right. People tend to argue both that the enemy is totally committed to its evil ideology and that he is willing to sell out for personal profit. You want to show that you're a good member of your tribe, Westwood told the New York Times. You want to show others that Republicans are bad or Democrats are bad and your tribe is good. Social media provides a unique opportunity to publicly declare to the world what your beliefs are and how willing you are to denigrate the opposition and reinforce your own political candidates. The desire for news that satisfies the popular lust for what might be called ecstatic schadenfreude, obscene pleasure at the sadness of others, has created a market, and when there is a market, entrepreneurs rush in. Hence the rise of fake news aimed at the trollish hordes of the left and the right who think saying, your tears are delicious, or butthurt, is an argument. Bias is endemic to all journalism. Fraud, however, while not new to journalism, is experiencing a kind of new golden age. Outright fabrications fly around the internet, fueled by pay-for-click ad rates and a burning desire among millions of people to see reality bend in their direction. Meanwhile, half-truths, which are often the most effective whole lies, saturate even respectable news organizations. Headlines have always erred on the side of the sensational, but in an era when millions of people only read the headlines and when much of the political conversation takes place in the 140-character realm of Twitter, the national conversation has become a noxious smog of feelings and desired yet fake facts. If a fanatic is someone who can't change his opinion and won't change the subject, then fanaticism runs amok on the left and the right these days. Of course, when a president believes that lies are true, if they feel true to him, falsehood has a powerful megaphone. Tyler Cowen, a brilliant economist at George Mason University, takes the somewhat too cynical view that much of ideological discourse can be boiled down to a desire to see the relative status of one group lowered or raised. He was talking about the rarefied world of academics and intellectuals, but it seems obviously even truer in the trenches of the political culture. Whatever you make of the underlying merits of the issues related to the Black Lives Matter movement, symbolically, it is very much an argument about the relative status of groups. The effort to force Christian bakers to make wedding cakes for same-sex marriages against their will has very little to do with tolerance and a great deal to do with a vengeful spirit that shouts out, "You will be made to care." When Hillary Clinton wrote off roughly half of Donald Trump's supporters as a basket of deplorables, those supporters turned it into a badge of honor and a foil for rhetorical vengeance. Again, I must point out that all of these trends are interrelated to and mutually reinforcing of each other. But one can only think critically about phenomena by isolating them. Mass immigration erodes mediating institutions, and the decline of these authentic communities fuels the migration to virtual communities online, where resentments are reinforced as like congregates with like, lending support to statements and attitudes we would normally never express in real life. This reinforcement encourages people to say them in real life. The resulting backlash is then celebrated as winning on the internet, which can be increasingly monetized. Immigration and economic churn make people feel insecure, so they go on Facebook, where people curate their lives to make it seem like everything is going swimmingly, and this breeds feelings of envy and status class anxiety. As Montesquieu said, "If one only wished to be happy, this could be easily accomplished. But we wish to be happier than other people, and this is always difficult, for we believe others to be happier than they are." And all of these trends cause people to search for new sources of identity in race, gender, sex, faith, and political affiliation. And as these shallow categories of self-understanding harden, tribal polarization intensifies. What we often call tribalism in modern democracies is actually, more properly speaking, what you might call coalitionalism. But coalitionalism isn't a word and sounds too much like normal politics, which has always been about building coalitions, even for tyrants, since the world was invented. Tribalism gets closer to the reality of our polarization. Conservatism was moving in the direction of identity politics for white people long before Trump, and it may have ended up where it is today sooner or later had he never run for president. But I believe the precipitating cause for the right's surrender to populism and tribalism was the failure of the Tea Parties. The populist movement that rose up to oppose President Obama was the only American populist cause I have ever sympathized with, never mind supported. I spoke to many Tea Party rallies. Why? Because as much as I dislike and distrust crowds, the Tea Parties married populism to the principles of the founding, demanding the government live within its means and abide by the Constitution. I met countless people from the little platoons of civil society who had become animated with passion for the primary documents of our civilization. They held book clubs and seminars in living rooms and rec centers. They studied how the debt and deficit work. When they held rallies, a few cranks would show, as happens whenever political enthusiasm is high and people gather. But the cranks were held at bay. The crowds cleaned up after themselves and took their citizenship seriously. There was passion, but it was married to principle. They succeeded in getting many politicians elected, but ultimately they failed by the standards they set for themselves at the outset. The banks got bailed out, Obamacare stayed in place, the debt grew bigger, taxes went up. But those failures are not what turned so many Tea Partiers into tribalists. It was the fact that, despite espousing the principles of the Constitution and arguing for wholly defensible and patriotic goals, whether you agree with them as a policy matter or not, they were still demonized by the media and Hollywood as racist yokels and boobs. This highlights the cancerous dynamic at work. If you tell people that, in effect, fighting for the Constitution and universal principles is just a white thing, then many of those whites will eventually agree with you. They will see the Constitution as the document of real Americans. But because the Constitution limits their power, they will eventually conclude that loyalty to the Constitution is a waste of time. What starts as a claim that only white people care about the Constitution ends with no one caring about the Constitution. We're not quite there yet, but in many quarters we're close. As bizarre as it sounds, there's a growing faction on the right who worship the by-any-means-necessary left-wing agitator Saul Alinsky. They believe the left brilliantly used his tactics to take over the country, and because we are in an existential battle, we must emulate their tactics. Chiefly, if the other side won't be constrained by the rules, then we shouldn't be either. When Trump's critics decry his violation of democratic norms, the immediate response is, what about Obama? And that is a very good question. But my response is, I criticized Obama for his violations of democratic norms, so I am consistent when I criticize Trump the same thing. The most reliable retort from Trump's biggest backers is, well, why should we abide by the rules when they don't? Donald Trump waded into this maelstrom of dysfunction and intensified it even further. For years, conservatives have complained that Republicans surrendered too easily. And as a senior editor of National Review, I would lose my executive washroom privileges if I dared claim this wasn't true. I don't need to recount the history of the New Deal or the Great Society to demonstrate that the GOP often finds itself dragged along in the tide of ever-growing government. Moreover, while I think that conservatives have the right side of the arguments on many cultural issues, this record of failure helps explain why Republicans often focus on symbolic social issues that rev up the base. The only problem is that Republicans often throw in the towel on those fights too. Part of this is simply the nature of conservatism. We tend, as Hayek said, to get pulled in directions not of our own choosing. In principle, that doesn't bother me, because giving society time to digest inevitable changes is an important function. Still, it would be nice to win more. Donald Trump tapped into this frustration as well, as all of his Charlie Sheen-like outbursts about winning illustrate. The problem is that winning and fighting are not standalone principles. In my numerous debates with many of Trump's biggest conservative supporters, I was constantly astounded by how many supposedly or formally principled conservatives had embraced winning and fighting as ends unto themselves. Trump could hurl the crudest epithets to defend an objectively immoral or politically indefensible position, and the response from his cheerleaders was, at least he fights. Trump has become an avatar of we the people, and winning has become decoupled from the substance of any victory. When he cannot declare victory, it is because others failed him or unfairly thwarted him. When he declares victory, the substance doesn't matter. When he does the incomprehensible, it is part of a genius we cannot appreciate. In short, for many people, it is simply a cult of personality. In the primaries, pollsters asked Republicans whether they favored single-payer health care, and the vast majority said no. When they were told Donald Trump supports it, accurate at the time, nearly a plurality suddenly supported it. In August of 2017, a poll found that half of Republicans would support postponing the 2020 elections if Donald Trump favored it. At the Conservative Political Action Committee, or CPAC, meeting in February of 2017, Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway suggested that the C in CPAC will be replaced with a T for Trump. That was a glib exaggeration, but listening to the audience cheer as he threw aside free trade in favor of his preferred economic nationalism, one could see how the ember of truth in her comment could grow into a flame. Barack Obama had a similar cult of personality. Celebrities pledged allegiance to the president. One columnist speculated whether he was a light worker, which he defined as that rare kind of attuned being who has the ability to lead us not merely to new foreign policies or healthcare plans or whatnot, but who can actually help usher in a new way of being on the planet, of relating and connecting and engaging with this bizarre earthly experiment. Deepak Chopra proclaimed that Obama represented a quantum leap in American consciousness. Barack Obama is our collective representation of our purest hopes, our highest visions, and our deepest knowings, proclaimed life coach Eve Constantine. He's our product of the all-knowing quantum field of intelligence. The mainstream media ignored all of this and much more because they were besotted with him too. We thought he was going to be the next Messiah, Barbara Walters confessed. And this too fueled deep feelings of resentment among millions of dissenting Americans who are not motivated by racism, but by simple disagreement, healthy skepticism, or plain old partisanship. But they were called racists nonetheless. The liberal pundits, reporters, and politicians who look at Donald Trump and ask, where did this monster come from, didn't create Donald Trump, and they certainly didn't vote for him, but they helped pile the kindling high for the flames of the backlash to come. Scholars studying such diverse phenomena as Islamic terrorism, white supremacy, street gangs, and cults have found that the key recruitment tool is always the same: the promise of meaning and belonging. Human beings are hardwired to want to belong, to be part of a cause larger than themselves, and to be valued for their contribution to that cause. Young people with scant social capital, i.e. dysfunctional families, unresponsive schools and communities, and so on, are the most susceptible to such appeals precisely because they have few alternative sources of meaning and belonging. This is the core insight of every Big Brother program and Boys and Girls Club. But the poor, the poorly educated, and those left behind by capitalism are not the only people susceptible to such appeals. We all are. Many of the 9/11 terrorists were well-educated. Osama bin Laden was rich. Modernity itself leaves many cold if they don't have the resources or opportunity to find healthy sources of meaning and belonging. In April 1993, Hillary Clinton delivered a commencement address to the University of Texas at Austin, in which she declared that we need a new politics of meaning. We need a new ethos of individual responsibility and caring. We need a new definition of civil society which answers the unanswerable questions posed by both the market forces and the governmental ones as to how we can have a society that fills us up again and makes us feel that we are part of something bigger than ourselves. In my first book, I subjected Clinton to withering criticism for her politics of meaning speech. I now think I was somewhat unfair. Her diagnosis had merit. It was consistent with the long tradition of critics of the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution to address the social question. People crave the sense of tribal solidarity that allowed us to evolve and to climb to the top of the food chain. Where I still stand in stark disagreement with Clinton is her remedy for the problem: more centralization. Like Obama, Clinton's answer is to give the state more power in an effort to satisfy our longing for meaning. That approach only fuels the problem because it makes the state the only source of meaning in our lives, which in turn fuels resentment among the millions who find the state's definition of meaning wanting. Prior to the Glorious Revolution, a Catholic in England felt that a Protestant on the throne was a threat to his or her whole place in the universe, and vice versa. That is the direction we are heading, and that direction is backward. When the president or a party in power is invested with that kind of meaning and significance, the outs feel like they are strangers in their own land, and the party in power does everything it can to exacerbate that feeling. Then, when the other party gets in, it gets its payback. The only solution is to break the cycle by making the state less important and letting the dying reefs of civil society grow back to health. That doesn't mean there aren't important things for the state to do.